You're listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. I'm Michael Welch. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. On today's broadcast, we will air excerpts from a webinar held on June 10th and focusing on the theme of how both NATO and the G7 are vehicles for the imperialist powers to dominate the globe and make the planet a great deal more dangerous. It was organized by the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network and featured three key voices, Owen Schalk, Tamara Lawrence, and Barbara Waldron. We'll go right into the conversation. First up, Owen Schalk speaks. He is the Winnipeg-based author of Canada in Afghanistan, a story of military, diplomatic, political, and media failure, 2003 to 2023. And the upcoming book, Targeting Libya, Canadian Dams, Canadian Bombs, on the Global Research News Hour in the summer.
The first quote is former U.S. President Richard Nixon. He said, quote, "The only collective body that ever worked was NATO. And that was because it was a military alliance and we, meaning the U.S., were in charge." Another quote from former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. He said somewhat famously, "We," meaning Canada, "had no defense policy, so to speak, except that of NATO. Our defense policy determined all of our foreign policy. And we had no foreign policy of any importance except that which flowed from NATO." So if you put these two statements together, what do we see? Well, we see that NATO is controlled by the U.S. government, and NATO determines Canadian foreign policy. Therefore, the U.S. government determines the Canadian government's foreign policy. And it's important that we understand that because in our current moment, NATO is driving the extremely dangerous militarization of global affairs. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, NATO members currently account for over half of all global military spending at 55%. And if NATO members commit to meeting the organization's new 5% of GDP target, which was recently announced by the Secretary General Mark Rutte, then NATO's military expenditures will grow to equal the entire world's current military spending, which is insanity. So NATO is a threat to the world through its imperialist interventions abroad, a threat to global ecology and the climate, of course, through the massive emissions and the environmental degradation of the different military-industrial complexes of NATO's members. And NATO's a threat to all of us as people in Canada, because a $150 billion military budget, which is what our government would spend if we met the 5% target, means fewer homes in Canada, means fewer schools, fewer hospitals, fewer jobs. It means it means public services drained of funds. So NATO's drive to militarize the world is a threat to all of us here watching and to everybody in our lives, not to mention to the world as a whole. But this isn't new. From its inception, NATO has been a dangerous and aggressive force on the world stage. And that's what I'm going to talk about now, specifically why NATO came into being in 1949, what its purpose was in U.S. foreign policy, how that purpose evolved, and what NATO's function is today. So this alliance, NATO, came into being 76 years ago with the signing of the North Atlantic Treaty in Washington. And as I explain in an upcoming book that I've written for ARP Books on NATO, NATO was the military component of a broader strategy on the part of Washington to subordinate Western Europe and Canada to U.S. economic and political interests. And NATO was the public military component of that campaign, but there were also cultural, economic, and clandestine dimensions to it too, which I'll talk about a bit today. And this is something I want to emphasize. NATO was not and is not a defensive alliance, and it has never existed purely as a military organization. It was and is an aggressive alliance, and it was and is overtly political. We see that, for instance, in the well-known statement from NATO's first Secretary General, Lord Ismay. Quote, "The purpose of the NATO alliance is to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down." And the conclusion that NATO is a political alliance and an aggressive one at that becomes unavoidable, I would argue, the more you delve into this history. So after World War II, Europe was in shambles, and the communist movement had widespread appeal due to the leading role of the Soviet Union and communist partisans in defeating Nazi Germany and its puppets. But there was nothing that the U.S. feared like a communist Western Europe. So it launched this multi-pronged offensive against the continent to keep Western Europe economically and politically subservient. And that agenda continues to this day, of course. The economic side of this post-war offensive was the Economic Recovery Program of 1948, or the Marshall Plan, which aimed to rebuild the continent to conform to U.S. capitalist accumulation patterns, namely Fordism. And the Marshall Plan was explicitly anti-communist. There's a quote from the Marshall Aid Administrator Paul Hoffman where he says, "Europe would have been communistic if it had not been for the Marshall Plan." So this was the explicit political goal of the economic dimension of this offensive. There was also a cultural side. And for that, the U.S. government deployed the Congress of Cultural Freedoms to suppress anti-capitalist literature and art and to promote culture more suited to the worldview of the White House and its conservative European allies. As for NATO, it was formed as the military aspect of this wider offensive. And NATO's operations weren't purely or even primarily public. For one, there were the alleged secret anti-communist protocols that member states had to sign before they joined, protocols that said new members would prevent communist parties from taking power, even through elections. And there was Operation Gladio, which was the term for NATO member Italy's secret anti-communist armies and terror operations. But that term, Gladio, has become a term used to refer to NATO's secret armies as a whole. And these armies were involved in coups, assassinations, and terror attacks across Western Europe, and their activities were coordinated at NATO's clandestine planning committee. These programs also included non-NATO members, including Sweden and Franco's Spain. Franco worked closely with NATO to suppress the Spanish left. And these secret armies, again, show the real purpose of America's offensive against post-war Europe, that purpose being the repression of the Western European left and the integration of Western Europe into a U.S.-led capitalist world system. So after the end of the Cold War in 1991, NATO's purpose transformed from pressuring the USSR from the West, while at the same time policing Western European politics to keep them subservient. It transformed into a global U.S.-led military alliance aimed at protecting and serving an increasingly globalized Euro-American capitalist class. And this change in NATO's purpose was a bonanza for arms dealers. Major U.S. weapons manufacturers like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin were very active in pushing NATO expansion. For example, a man named Bruce Jackson, who was the director of strategic planning at Lockheed Martin, also founded the U.S. Committee to Expand NATO. And the Committee to Expand NATO lobbied not only U.S. officials. Jackson effectively became a U.S. diplomat, flying around Central and Eastern Europe and convincing all these newly post-socialist countries to join the U.S.-led Euro-American alliance. Of course, this expansion, while a goldmine for the weapons industry, was in complete contravention to a promise made to Russia about NATO's eastward expansion. Everybody, I'm sure, has heard of the not one inch east promise made by James Baker to Gorbachev, but it wasn't just James Baker, and it wasn't just one promise. It was repeated promises by Baker, by President George H.W. Bush, by West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl, and Vice Chancellor Hans-Dietrich Genscher. This is all outlined in a book called Not One Inch by M.E. Surratt, which is a newer book, and she's a very decorated American historian on the post-Cold War era. Everybody should check it out. But the U.S. never intended to keep that promise about expansion, because implementing that promise would have meant reining in U.S. capital and it would have meant leaving these newly capitalist states across Central and Eastern Europe in potentially unstable positions. And NATO's European policy at this point, it was all about securing what they thought of as the gains of the fall of socialism, as well as securing markets for the expansion of Euro-American and primarily U.S. capital. So where does Canada fit into this question of NATO expansion? Because it wasn't just the U.S. Pushing expansion. Canada played a very prominent role as well, sometimes even more aggressive than the U.S. Starting in 1993, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien was pushing for Poland to join NATO 6 years before Poland actually joined. According to a 1994 article in the Edmonton Journal, quote, Prime Minister Chrétien said the U.S. plan doesn't move fast enough to incorporate Poland and some other countries into the NATO military alliance. Chrétien made a very alarming statement at that time where he said that the West had a, quote, moral obligation to expand NATO into, quote, those countries that had been enslaved by communism. Of course, Russia was warning against this expansion from the very beginning, long before Putin took power, but those warnings went unheeded. In this era, part of NATO's new globalized agenda was also the destruction of remaining economic alternatives. And we saw that dynamic play out in the collapse of Yugoslavia and NATO's war on Serbia in the 90s. NATO's war decimated and fragmented an already increasingly fragmented Yugoslavian nation and turned it into, in the words of Michael Parenti, a beggar poor country of cheap labor and rich resources available at bargain prices, defenseless against capital penetration, so divided that it would never reunite. During its war on Serbia, NATO bombed many non-military targets, including sanitation and electricity systems, not to mention libraries, theaters, hospitals, senior care homes, and television and radio stations. The war also ruptured the West's relationship with Russia at the time because Serbia was a close Russian ally, but also China because the U.S. bombed and destroyed China's embassy in Belgrade, which is something that the Chinese government and people still remember very well, even if we've forgotten about it. The Canadian role in this war should also be highlighted. So during the 78-day assault, Canadian CF-18s dropped 530 bombs on Serbia, and Canada overall was the third largest contributing nation to that war, according to a scholar by the name of Benjamin Zyla. After the Serbia war, NATO's aggressions continued with the wars in Afghanistan and, of course, Libya. I published a book on Canada's war in Afghanistan in 2023, and I've written a new one about Canada in Libya, which should be out this fall. But to keep this part relatively short, I would just say that these wars, Afghanistan and Libya, each had their own dynamics and their own internal logics relating to the various players involved, which I try to unpack in my writings. But to simplify, both of those wars represented attempts by NATO to do what NATO has done since its inception. That is, discipline areas of the world that oppose the US-led Atlantic alliance and extend into those areas Atlantic military power and economic power in order to maintain this post-Cold War unipolar moment where the US dictates how the rest of the world should conduct its affairs. But by the time of the overthrow of Gaddafi in late 2011, it became clear that the unipolar moment of U.S. power would not last forever. Russia and China were becoming increasingly influential global powers, especially China. So what we saw after the destruction of Libya, which was the main African alternative to U.S. power, what we saw was another reorientation of NATO, this time against Russia and against China. And I'll just say, coming toward my conclusion, that NATO expansion was clearly the trigger for the war in Ukraine. Anyone who has honestly researched the history of NATO should know that. And that war in Ukraine has been used by the U.S. and by extension NATO to incapacitate another competitor to the Atlantic alliance in Russia. And NATO's actions in China seem designed to spark a similar conflict there with the goal of weakening China. NATO powers, including Canada, are conducting provocative operations near China, sailing warships there. And NATO is deepening its cooperation with regional allies in East Asia, like Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, and the Philippines. And given the devastation that NATO's expansion has wrought around the world, one can only shudder to imagine what NATO warmongers have planned in East Asia. And before I close, I want to talk briefly about Mark Carney, because he came to power promising that the old relationship with the US is over. But so far, all I see is continuity and even deepening military integration. Carney has continued to commit Canada to supporting the global goals of NATO, which is an aggressive, nuclear, US-controlled military alliance. And outside of NATO, even, we remain extremely economically tied to the US war machine and the US economy in general. Now, if, in fact, the Carney government wanted to forge an independent path in global and domestic affairs, I would argue that it should do two things. One, withdraw from NATO and become a militarily non-aligned power, which would also mean Canada ending its participation in the war in Ukraine and ending its support for the genocide of Palestinians. And two, deepen Canada's economic relationship with the global majority as represented by BRICS. Now, obviously, Carney is not going to do either of those things. So whatever he says about Canadian sovereignty and independence vis-a-vis the United States is nothing but smoke and mirrors. But Canadians who value peace, independence, and more globally equitable international setups know what Canada must do to support that vision. And it does not mean continuing to support U.S. imperialism and warmongering around the world. What it does mean is finding new economic relationships outside the U.S., outside the G7, and it means completely and unconditionally withdrawing from NATO. And I'm so glad that there are a large number of Canadians who agree with me and who are willing and eager to organize around those demands. So thank you.
That was writer Owen Schalk. Barbara Waldron is a longtime anti-imperialist activist in BC and South Korea for just peace and democratic rights. She is currently the coordinator for Just Peace Committee and on the British Columbia Anti-Militarization Campaign Committee of the International League for People in Struggle. She has a master's degree in social science and a post-baccalaureate diploma in social policy at Simon Fraser University. Here's her contribution to the discussion.
The G7 is a block of countries. If you look at them, they all have been colonial countries. Japan as well was a major colonial force in Asia, right? All of them except Japan are the founding nations of, or some of the founding nations of NATO. So these are the most advanced, or have been the most advanced industrialized countries, consider themselves democracies, bourgeois or liberal democracies, limited democracies. Russia used to be included. It used to be the G8. And it does have observer members like Ukraine, and Zelensky is invited, is going to be at this meeting coming up in Alberta. And the European Union is having a special role. And there are seven of them. So every 7 years, Canada comes up for its turn as the host. It has hosted the G7 before. The last time was in 2018. It hosted in Kananaskis, which is the Rocky Mountains, right? The recreational area in the Rocky Mountains between near Banff and near Calgary. It hosted there in 2004, and that was the height of the anti-globalization movement. So there were 10,000 people that protested, and there was quite a big clash of interests with the protesters getting right up to close to the venue. But this year, the venue is being even more fortified, and all the city of Calgary and the airport are all fortified. Banff is fortified. We'll talk about that in a bit. So these countries are among the richest, and today they have somewhere between 25.5% to 29%. There are some sources that say it's a little higher. I just did some digging. According to Statista.com and VisualCapitalist.com, these countries had a combined share of the global GDP of 66% of the GDP in 1990. So what's happened then? There have been crisis after crisis, right? And with crisis after crisis, there's been more and more militarization. And that's around the time that where Owen said the NATO shifted to become the defender of the capitalist class in the world. And its militarization extended. And he talked about the Yugoslav War, Jean Chrétien, the prime minister at the time, pushing to expand NATO and NATO expanding the Yugoslav War. So this all this militarization and intensified war and war industry has increased as the decline of their share of the global GDP occurs. In 2022, they had 40% of the global GDP. This is not long after 2025, and it's 25.5, maybe 29%. So they are worried. And they know that this is an opportunity for not only the rival countries, rival states to benefit, and that a lot of the wealth of the world is shifting to other countries. You know, of course, Russia, Brazil, India, China's economies are all growing. But it's also an opportunity for liberation struggles. And we can see that they really don't want any liberation struggle to succeed. And that's what Palestine, digging their heels into the Palestine struggle is all about, as well as the ideologies and so on surrounding that. So that is my thesis, and our thesis in the ILPS. So just go through this. We go through all the countries so you can look at how much wealth they have and how much they're involved in militarization. So I just wanted to highlight Canada because our Prime Minister Mark Carney has announced further militarization. This is a solution, he says, to getting Canada more independence and building our nation. Of course, it's totally false. Militarizing our economy and our country and joining in the military campaigns in the world is not benefiting the people of Canada or any of the people anywhere else. And it's a contradiction. There's nothing here about defending our sovereignty. In fact, he is kowtowing to NATO and the NATO agenda, which means kowtowing to the US and its role in the world. And they're just as desperate to maintain their hegemony over the world. So we just go through all these countries. I'll just skip through this. Oh, sorry. Okay. So hand in hand with their economic agenda of trying to protect markets, keep the profits rolling in, while most of the world becomes poorer and poorer, and the people who share the world, the most of the wealth are fewer and fewer. They are militarizing, using the war industry for profits and all the spin-off, the communications industries and so on, IT, communication, AI, and so on with this. And this is why, for example, G7 is going to talk about AI so much. So these are other alliances along with NATO. There is the one in Asia, Australia, UK, US alliance. They all have developed an Indo-Pacific strategy. And they're all building on former agreements and pacts. They're nuclear armed countries. US, of course, is the only one that's used it, and they're threatening to use them again. It's very dangerous in terms of the potential for nuclear war today. NATO has made a recommitment to nuclear weapons. Tamara talked about the Russia-Ukraine war, what that's all about, expanding NATO, trying to challenge Russia, exploiting the people of Ukraine and the situation there, pretending they're for peace and democracy. So the economic program of neoliberalization, it goes hand in hand with their military, their security agenda, of course. So they've tried to continue to enslave other countries through their lending programs and dominating the markets for lands and seed and all the minerals and energy, privatizing all of that and trying to monopolize that. And we know Canada is very much involved in the minerals and energy. It's a leader and a provider, minerals and energy, to the war machine. As I said, the AI is on the agenda. They're not really revealing a whole lot about that. So, preparing for the G7 summit, there was the Foreign Ministers Summit held in Banff earlier in the year. And this is where we could see the whole agenda. They're talking about what's going on in other countries and what they should be doing in other countries. So, it has nothing to do with improving their own societies and building their own nations and helping the people in their own countries. They're really concerned with their status in the world and world domination, and they're planning more aggression, more militarization for that. Okay, so the agenda, as we said, from international peace and security to global economic stability and growth to digital transition, today's global challenges and opportunities require us to work to find shared solutions. But the solutions for the tiny minority that rules the world and not for us. When they talk about security and defense, is to defend their own role. So ILPS in Canada, which is the International League of People's Struggle, is answering the situation by developing its own anti-militarization program. And so this year they targeted the CANSEC Arms Trade Show. So we were part in organizing that and in protesting there. And I should say, I'm mentioning ILPS because I'm with Just Peace Committee and they're a member organization. So I've been on the organizing committee to plan the next target, the demonstration and the counter summit next weekend in Alberta to challenge the G7. So we're protesting the G7 on principle. We should challenge, confront these leaders when they're right in our land or in our own country, and we should challenge what they're doing in the world. But more importantly, it's another chance to bring together more organizations to build our understanding together, to talk together and share some activities and build our movement together. That's the most important thing. It will take millions and millions of people opposing what they're doing to the point where we can influence the young people that go into the military and the police forces. When we can influence them and they question what's going on, then the people's movements can win. The third thing that we're going to do this year is on the west side of the country. There is the aerospace and defense exhibition, which we haven't been protesting, but now we think we're in a position to do that. It takes place just outside the Vancouver metro area in the Fraser Valley, and air show happens at the same time, and they are part of the whole exhibition. So it's mostly a military air show. We'll be doing that in August. Of course, we have a plan to march on the Sunday, the 15th, the day after our People's Summit. We have a plan to go to some of the consulates of the G7 countries and an energy firm building, as well as a Canada government building.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer on radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. We are listening this hour to audio from a June 10th webinar entitled How Imperialists Use NATO and G7 to Maintain Global Domination. a webinar of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. Tamara Lawrence is a PhD student at the Balsillie School of International Relations. She at the University of Waterloo, a member of Canadian Voice of Women for Peace and the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom Canada. Here she speaks on NATO and the G7.
I am going to talk tonight about some troubling G7 and NATO statements and developments. Then I'm going to close by sharing a little bit of hope and what activists are doing to push back and some upcoming events. So the G7, as Janine said, is the six NATO countries, Canada, the US, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, and the European Council, and Japan. And Japan is a NATO ally, of course. The G7 is effectively NATO. They are one in the same. NATO is the military alliance, and the G7 is the economic alliance. And the United States dominates both of them. In May, the G7 finance ministers and the central bank governors released a statement about their priorities. And three of them are, number one, stopping terrorist financing. Two, supporting critical supply chains in Latin America and the Caribbean. And three, continuing the unwavering support for Ukraine. Notice us the critical mineral supply chain. That's very much for continuing to produce weapons. And notice that they are calling for their unwavering support for Ukraine, but they are silent about Israel's genocide in Gaza. And what is the real objective of the G7 and NATO? It's to protect this unjust world order that has repeatedly been articulated by the NATO Secretary Generals. This is what the former NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said last year. He said this quote many times, quote, "Together with NATO allies, we account for 50% of the world's economic might and 50% of the world's military might. And we have to remember that the US has never fought alone in a war. They've always been together with all of the other allies. NATO protects 1 billion of our civilians." Now think about that. The 32 wealthy Western countries control 50% of the global economy and the global militaries. Yet there are 193 countries in the United Nations system, and this G7 NATO world order excludes the majority of them. 161 countries representing 7 billion people. You know, they're outside of this. The G7 NATO world order is profoundly racist, avaricious, and vicious. And how did the G7 NATO achieve this domination? Through mass violence and mass plundering that Owen was just articulating, by bombing and breaking up Yugoslavia, bombing and occupying Afghanistan, bombing Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Palestine. It is the same playbook every time. The US and NATO arms rebels, demonize and assassinates leaders, divides communities, manufactures atrocities, ignores peace proposals, enacts punishing sanctions, and devastates communities, all with no accountability. And this is the playbook that has been used for the proxy wars in Ukraine and the genocide in Gaza. They are both NATO proxy wars financed by the G7. And this is what the British Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, admitted on Sky News on May 25th. It's all related. Israel is fighting a proxy war on behalf of the UK, just like Ukraine is on behalf of Western Europe against Russia. Similarly, in a Telegraph interview in November of last year, former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson admitted the same thing, quote, "We're morally responsible for their Ukrainian predicament. We helped to create this nightmare. Let's face it, we're waging a proxy war, but we're not giving our proxies the tools to do their job. For years and years now, we've been allowing them to fight with one hand tied behind their backs. It's been cruel. Marco Rubio, also on March 6th of this year, admitted that it's a NATO-Ukraine proxy war against Russia. And remember, in April of 2022, Boris Johnson went to Kyiv to tell Zelensky not to negotiate with Russia and to fight instead. And that is the same month that Zelensky said, make Ukraine the Israel of Europe. And that's also when the Atlantic Council released their roadmap for making Ukraine the Israel of Europe. Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan are the three proxies of NATO and part of a three-front war against Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea for the control of Eurasia. The US and NATO allies have been wanting to control this huge land mass, which is rich in natural resources, since the end of the Cold War, and they have been maneuvering to take it over for 30 years. They want Russia, China, Iran, and North Korea. They want to do to these four countries what they did to Yugoslavia, Libya, and Syria so successfully, bomb and break them apart. So you can see that Russia, Iran, or North Korea are ringed by 750 US NATO military bases and 11 US commands. The US and NATO have, subjugated and plundered Latin America and Africa and so much of Asia, and now they're going after these countries. And they're very overt about this. On May 30th, the US Secretary of Defense, Peter Hegseth, he laid it out in a major address at the Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore, in which he called China an imminent threat, and the US and NATO are preparing for war with it. Yesterday, the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte also outlined this plan in a major hawkish speech in Chatham House in the UK. Rutte said, Russia has teamed up with China, North Korea, and Iran. They are expanding their militaries and their capabilities. Russia could be ready to use military force against NATO within 5 years. There is no longer East or West. There is just NATO. China is also modernizing and it's expanding its military at breakneck speed. Those who stand against freedom and democracy are digging in, preparing for long-term confrontation and trying to dominate and divide us. Unquote. This is doublespeak. It is the exact opposite. It is NATO that is starting the confrontation and the chaos. Rutte also said that NATO allies would commit to 5% GDP target, an increase in military spending at the upcoming NATO summit, precisely to prepare for this global war. On the same day, our Prime Minister Mark Carney released his plan to meet the NATO 2% target this year, as Janine mentioned. And this is going to mean an immediate injection of $9 billion to the military. In the past 10 years, Canada's military spending has increased 100% to $41 billion last year, and now we're going to go over $50 billion. And we are also going to make a commitment to increase military spending in the next decade to 5% of GDP. But friends, we have to work really hard to stop this. So Canada is currently ranked 16th highest, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as Owen mentioned, and of the 25 highest military spenders, it's mostly the NATO countries. And according to CPRI's arms transfers, the NATO countries are also mostly in the top 25 for weapons deals. Canada's ranked 16th highest for arms transfers. So NATO really is a weapons dealer, and all of this militarization will cause mass immiseration of our population and exacerbate climate and ecological breakdown. We are experiencing again horrendous wildfires across our country. I want to mention that last year, NATO with Canada's, of course, support, established a Center of Excellence for Climate and Security. I wrote an article that was in the Canadian Dimension called Greenwashing NATO. This is a greenwashing exercise. If we are serious about protecting the climate and protecting the environment, the most important thing that we need to do is abolish NATO. Here is a glimmer of hope in this horrible sea of despair. 2 weeks ago, on May 27th, the 11 ASEAN countries and the six countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council and China, they all met in Kuala Lumpur, and they released in a really important statement. Here's a quote from it. "We endeavor to promote peace, security, stability, and prosperity through mutual respect and cooperation between countries to achieve development and progress based on adherence to international law, including the UN Charter and the principles of good neighborliness. And we appreciate China's crucial role in promoting peace, stability, prosperity, and sustainable development in regional and international affairs." That same month, China and Indonesia also had a bilateral meeting to mark the 70th anniversary of the Bandung Conference. This was the conference between the newly independent Asia Pacific countries. It was held in Bandung, Indonesia in 1955. And this is what the Indonesian president, Subianto, said just last month. "I want to express my respects to the People's Republic of China, which has consistently defended the interests of developing countries. They've consistently opposed oppression, opposed imperialism, opposed colonialism, and opposed apartheid. The People's Republic of China supported liberation struggles in all countries, not just at the present when China's economy has been strong, but even when China was still developing. China continued to defend liberation struggles everywhere and until today. We see China especially defending the Palestinian people, which is truly something that makes us all so proud. From my heart and on behalf of the Indonesian people, we express our respect to the leadership of the People's Republic of China in defending the oppressed people all over the world." And our country, with the other NATO countries, are right now preparing for war with China. This is an outrage. I also want to mention that China and Indonesia are part of the BRICS, and this is another hopeful development. As Owen mentioned, last September, I was in St. Petersburg, Russia for the Women's BRICS meeting. It was a real honor to be there with women from all around the world who are mobilizing to use the BRICS platform for cooperation and sustainable development. And I also want to mention that today is the first UN International Day of Dialogue Among Civilizations. Dialogue serves as a bridge to find common ground in addressing pressing challenges of our time, ultimately contributing to world peace, human welfare, development, and progress. This is what humanity wants, but this is what NATO and the G7 are preventing. They don't want dialogue and sustainable development. They want domination and war. So it is up to us to engage in people-to-people diplomacy and dialogue. China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea are not our enemies. They are our neighbors. Finally, I want to bring to your attention two excellent podcasts hosted recently by Dr. Pascal Lotaz of Neutrality Studies. So one is about the NATO People Summit and protest that is going to be taking place later this month. And the other podcast was an interview with Dr. Danielle Ganser, who wrote the book about NATO's secret army. So please check those out, and I'll put a link in the chat. This Sunday, June 25th at 12 p.m. Eastern, UNAC is having a webinar against NATO. The following Sunday, on June 22nd at 11 a.m. Eastern, the Global Women United for Peace Against NATO, of which I am a part, and Vow and Wilp are as well. They will be having a live stream from the People's Counter Summit Against NATO in the Netherlands. And then June 24th and 25th, there will be a massive protest against NATO in The Hague, and they will also have a live stream. I would love it, friends, if we across Canada could do actions on the 24th and 25th publicly to say Canada out of NATO. And then my last hopeful sign, of course, is the Global March for Gaza on June 15th. This march is so wonderful, as well as the attempt to break the siege by the Madeleine. So, friends, let's stick together. Let's work for peace and justice. Canada out of NATO, Canada out of the G7, Canada out of NATO, Canada out of the G7. Thank you.
Owen Schalk, Tamara Lawrence, and Barbara Waldron responded to questions from the audience. Janine Solanke, who sits on the coordinating committee of the Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network, put these questions to the speakers.
So the first question is, first of all, one that has been responded to by a few people, but and anyone can also post this in the chat, is a request for easily digestible and accessible resources, such as a short documentary that would summarize the history of NATO's imperialism and goals to share with others. I'm sure our speakers have some resources, and I think a few people have posted in the chat already, but I'll open that for any of our speakers to respond to. And also a question about the genocide in Gaza and understanding that the Zionists want to take over the land of Palestine and Gaza, despite that they're destroying it and making it uninhabitable for many years. But the question is, what does NATO get out of the genocide in Gaza in terms of military contracts, oil off the coast of Gaza, or any other reasons. So I'll start with those two questions, and I'll ask if any of our speakers would like to respond to that.
Sure, I can start on the second question about Gaza. I think in order to answer that question, we should think about what function Israel has served throughout its existence. It's always been an extension of Western military power. Just look at the countries that Israel has targeted. Nasser's Egypt was one of the first. Now, yes, it's Gaza, it's Palestine, also Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, Iran. Any country that aligns itself with the so-called axis of resistance, Israel is there to discipline them and to overthrow them if need be. And there was an article published during the late Biden administration. I think it was in the Huffington Post first, and then it was sort of disseminated throughout US media, which laid out what they called the Biden doctrine for Gaza. And they quote several officials in the Biden administration, specifically Brett McGurk, who served in many Democratic and Republican administrations, advising them on foreign policy. And they outline what the Biden administration's plan for Gaza was, should the genocide have succeeded while he was in power. And the plan was destroy Gaza, wipe out Palestinian resistance forces in Gaza, and then have the Gulf monarchies come in to rebuild Gaza, quote unquote, and to have the new Gaza aligned geopolitically with the U.S. After that, the plan was to divert U.S. military resources toward Iran, also Syria, but that mission accomplished there as far as the U.S. and Israel are concerned. And then after either overthrowing the Iranian government or sufficiently weakening the Iranian government, then the U.S. would shift its military resources toward China. And I don't think this Biden doctrine has changed in the Trump administration. I think it's now the Trump doctrine for Gaza. So yes, the war in Gaza, the genocide in Gaza that the West is supporting, it is about resources, like regional resources, regional power. But it's not just about that region. It's also about Western hegemony more broadly, wiping out Palestinian resistance to then wipe out resistance in the region to then target major geopolitical competitors like China. Yeah, I think that analysis really highlights what the Western plan for Gaza is.
Thanks, Owen. Tamara, go ahead.
Can I just add to what Owen said, that just think about the fact that Israel was established out of the British Mandate in 1948 at the same time that NATO was established. And when you look back at the history, some of the older text on NATO, it will talk about the role that Israel has played too to try to suppress communist movements in the Middle East. It was also directed against the Soviet Union. And then also think about the fact that in 1989, US President Ronald Reagan made Israel a major non-NATO ally for the alliance, and then Israel became part of the Mediterranean dialogue and started to do a lot of exercises with the alliance in the 1990s. This also allowed for more arms transfers between the NATO allies and Israel. And then in 2016, Israel established an office right inside the NATO headquarters in Brussels. And 3 days after the Hamas attack, Israel had a meeting with the NATO allies, and they coordinated on weapons transfers. So this is why I say that the genocide in Gaza is not just a US-Israeli genocide. It is also a NATO genocide. NATO is deeply involved in this. They're totally complicit, and they're arming it and funding it. And then on the resources, I would like to just bring to your attention, if you go to wilpcanada.ca, I'll put a link in the chat. There is a tab that says resources, and there's a whole bunch of two-page fact sheets. And so I have a fact sheet that I've done on NATO in French and English that you can download and pass out. And I also want to address something in the chat where people said about what we should do to take on NATO and calling for Canada to get out of the alliance. Last year, I was able to successfully get a parliamentary petition introduced in the House by my member of parliament calling for Canada out of NATO, and she actually read most of it into the Hansard, into the public record. I would like to urge you all, and I'll put my email in the chat, to call on your member of parliament to host a parliamentary petition to call for Canada out of NATO. I think that would be really fantastic. And then I also think that public protests are important. I think it's important for the public to see Canadians with signs, bravely saying Canada out of NATO. And as well, take letters, take my two-page fact sheet to your member of parliament office and say Canada out of NATO. We need to do everything. We need to do everything that we can to bring down this warmongering alliance, but we are not alone. We are working with allies around the world trying to disband NATO. So just do whatever you feel comfortable doing and keep doing it. Thanks.
I am wondering if anyone can speak to the US-EU split in the context of Canada's pivot towards the EU, rearm Europe, and the Coalition of the Willing, which seeks to put boots on the ground in an unsanctioned, illegal, dirty war in Ukraine. So important question there. And then also another question about invitations by Carney to President Modi of India and Salman al-Saud. Al-Saud is a sign of irresponsible militarism, also by not inviting Pakistan as well. And what about not inviting Lula da Silva from Brazil? Carney tries to lure countries away from the Shanghai Organization and from BRICS. And then one other question that I'll put to the speakers, and maybe we'll take another round of questions after this before we wrap up. So the question is, no, the Nova Scotia government is asking for mining exploration proposals, including in my neighborhood. What happens to uranium mined in Canada, and does some go into nuclear weapons or end up being used in depleted uranium bombs? So I'll put those to our three speakers.
Well, I can just add a little bit on the EU-US split, and what that means geopolitically. So I don't view the EU as operating separately from US power and US geopolitical objectives. I think there is clearly disagreement between those who rule Europe and the Trump administration over how to proceed in Ukraine. We see Europe undertaking rearmament through Rearm Europe, which Canada is participating in, as Carney has now announced. In one sense, Rearm Europe is Europe's statement to the US that, yeah, we're going to keep arming Ukraine with or without you. But on the other hand, it also serves Trump's global agenda and his vision for NATO, which is Europe spends more on its own defense so that the US spends less there. So the tensions are there, most clearly in Ukraine. And another commenter brought up China and the question of whether or not Europe would go along with increased US aggression toward China. I think it seems to me that the European ruling class is focused right now on Russia and would prefer to prolong the war against Russia as opposed to pivoting to a new war against China. But I also think that the European ruling class is so spineless and so lacking in imagination that if the US were to stoke a war with China, Europe would just go along with it. We saw how the EU rolled over with the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, for instance, with the blowback of the anti-Russia sanctions on European economies. They all doubled down. So Europe's leaders are utterly lacking in imagination and in vision. And to me, this just confirms that the future is with the global majority. It's with BRICS. It's not with the G7. It's not with NATO. And again, that just reaffirms that Canada needs to get out of these alliances and to diversify and deepen its relationships with the global South.
You've been listening to an edited for radio version of the June 10th webinar entitled How Imperialists Use NATO and G7 to Maintain Global Domination. It was organized by Canada-wide Peace and Justice Network. To learn more about the topic of the organization itself, visit the website peaceandjustice.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour in the Summer, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Music was Shifting Sands from Purple Planet Music. It can be found on the website purple-planet.com. My name is Michael Welch. Join us again next week.